Requesting connection. Established. Encrypted. We're live. The show you've been asking for. Advice, technology, and community. Linux first, all others second. This is Ask Noah.
Live from the Pacific Ocean, the Ask Noah show starts right now. This is the show where we came to do all the things on Linux they said couldn't be done and take your questions on how to do the same. My name is Noah. I am your host. Delighted to be here with you as another episode of the Ask Noah show kicks off this hour. Joining me, my co-host, Mr. Steve Ovens. Welcome in, sir.
Well, it's warm here, but I don't think it's on the scale of where you're at right now in the world.
Man, I tell you what, they're absolutely... So, backstory, I'm in California for the Southern California Linux Expo. As part of that, it happened to align perfectly with my children's spring break, so we thought, why not go down a week early and give the kids the California experience? Steve, if you're not familiar with the California experience, I would describe it the following. Take what you'd pay for a meal in South Dakota or North Dakota and double it, and then take the amount of cars on the road and times about 10. That is the California experience, coupled with absolutely beautiful scenery. So I am live on Manhattan Beach in California, and it is absolutely gorgeous here waiting for scale. And yes, it is warm. I left like 20 above weather, and I arrived at 40, 50 degree weather.
Yeah, I mean, here it's been quite nice. We walk outside, and it got to like 40 degrees, and my wife's like, open up all the windows. It's springtime, you know, like we've got the air flowing through. That's how you know you've adapted to life in the north when, you know, she used to complain that 60 degrees was cold, and now we come out of winter and 40 degrees is time to open up the house.
Absolutely. You ready to get into some feedback, Steve?
Let's do it.
All right. Our first email comes in from Wayne. Wayne writes in and says, "Hi, Noah and Steve. Thanks for the show. I'm a longtime listener. I work for a charitable organization, and budget has always been an issue for as long as I've been an employee here. With Windows 10 EOL looming, every single computer we currently own is incapable of running Windows 11. I looked into Windows Virtual PC. It's too expensive for us, and Azure Virtual Desktop is also too expensive for us. I remember in a previous episode, you mentioned that you have given clients Linux Desktop and virtualized Windows for those users. Did you create a virtual Windows computer for every user in the office? Or do you host, let's say, 5 Windows VM for 8 staff for everyone in the office every day? How much RAM and disk are you allocating to each VM? Are you gigabit Ethernet adapters? Are they good enough for the required throughput? Did you set up Linux boxes to automatically open the Windows VM startup at startup? Our office has approximately 8 to 12 users in the office at any given time. I was going to repurpose a Dell R430. I welcome any feedback that you have on this topic. Many thanks." Okay, so let's start here, Steve. The opening of this program, every week, I say, we're here to do the things on Linux they said couldn't be done in teach you how, or answer your questions on how to do the same. The rationale behind that opening is people have been telling me for years, oh, you have to have Windows to do that, or you can't do that without Windows. And what you find is, when you really dig into it, if you really dig into it deep, what you find is that, in fact, you can do most of the things on Linux. You just have to be willing to separate out your tasks from your desires. That is to say, instead of, I desire to use Microsoft Office, my task is, I want to compose a Word document, or I want to check my email. And if you're willing to do that, Linux is the nonprofit and church's best friend. And I've had tremendous amount of success going into these places and saying, okay, I want you to strip away everything you think you know or understand about technology, and I want you to come back to the basics. What are you actually looking to solve here? You write those things down. And then usually what myself or one of our techs will do is we will dig and understand their workflow. So one of the projects that we were talking about in the past few weeks with this package company, we spent a whole day at this business so that we could learn the package industry. Not that we care about the package industry, but in order to write and support software about the package industry, we have to understand how to do their job. And once we understand how to do their job as the techies, then we can say, if I know what technology is capable of, here's how I would leverage it to their benefit. And so I would be remiss if I didn't tell you the best thing you could do, or the most straightforward answer to your question, is ditch Windows. Windows doesn't want you to be their customer. Microsoft doesn't want you to be their customer. They want you to buy new hardware. You don't want new hardware. If the hardware that you have is capable of doing the same tasks it did when you purchased it, why not just get rid of Windows and go to something else? So that's my first recommendation. That said, every once in a while, there is a client and they have some esoteric snowflake piece of software that only runs on Windows. In those cases, what he is talking about is accurate. That's what we do. We virtualize Windows. So how do we do it? To start, we take a basic either CentOS, Alma Linux, Red Hat box, and install libvirt. And that gives us a virtual host. Now we can virtualize Windows boxes. Now, to his question, there's two ways to do it. Do you assign a VM to every single user, or do you have a set amount of VMs and then let share them as a pool among users? There's a couple different ways to crack that egg. So in the event that you have esoteric pieces of software that people need to use every once in a while, that's where the shared resource pool comes in. Hey, here's the QuickBooks machine, right? And if you're using QuickBooks, you have a Linux box, and when you need it, you remote into the QuickBooks machine. What software do we use for that? Remina. Remina works great. It's a fantastic RDP client. And oh, by the way, is in desperate need of a maintainer, because I think the guy that was running it is doing no more, and I think it's being replaced largely in the industry with XRDP. I digress. So that, if you have a shared pool, that's a great way to do it. If you want to get more fancy and elaborate, you can use something like OVH, which will actually allow you to assign, hey, when somebody calls for this resource, spin up the VM or hand them this VM and then return it back into the queue, that sort of thing. For offices that live, eat, and breathe Windows, and we absolutely have a few of them, they refuse to change, they like the way things are, but we as an IT company don't want to manage a bunch of physical Windows boxes, nor do we want to have to put up with the nonsense you're putting up with. That is to say, Microsoft just decides, hey, we want this new piece of hardware in order for you to run the latest version of Windows. You know, the version that was never supposed to come because 10 was going to be the last version ever. You remember that one? What we do in that instance, we set up a separate VM for every user. And then we either have a Linux box that will remote in, and you can use Remina, something like that. Sometimes if they already have Windows PCs or they have Windows laptops or Macs, we'll use that. And the third option is a company called ThinLinx, Thin, L-I-N-X. And what ThinLinx does is it turns a Raspberry Pi into a Thin client. And so you can program it to automatically connect to a specific RDP connection. So the user, all they know is they walk in and they turn on their box, and from their perspective, it boots right into a Windows environment. And then they type in their password. The part they don't know is underneath the hood, it's Linux running, driving what they're actually using, and it's just establishing an RDP connection back to the VM. Steve, what do you I know you're not much of a Windows guy, and I would think that in your line of work, you probably don't get a whole lot of requests to set up Windows boxes. What do you think of my strategy?
I mean, I guess it's the best thing that you can do. I don't know. As time gets older. Wow, mixing the metaphors. As time moves on, I'm less inclined to tilt too hard against other people approximately my age when it comes to changing their ways, because I've found that is less successful. Now, if they're open to the idea, you know, and you can convince them that it's just another program and it doesn't really, like, it does the same thing, then fine. When I was, you know, dialed back the clock 15 years, I had been all about trying to convince people to switch their thing and use Linux. But I've found that when you get into the convincing mode, that's when you run into all kinds of problems, because you end up with them constantly comparing the thing that they wanted to do with the thing that they were convinced to do, and that just goes terribly for you. And so
a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still.
Yes, that is a very true statement.
So I admittedly I have probably fallen victim to the same thing that you're talking about, right? It's evidenced. If you followed me for any number of years, you've watched things as we did, like Linux challenges and stuff, and going to convince people. So there's a bit of a Linux evangelist inside of me, and I'm not really ashamed of it. I would say that my belief hasn't really changed, insofar as I believe people are better served by leveraging open source technology than the proprietary alternative. The other part of that is, I'm kind of selfish, Steve, and I'm a bit lazy, and I'm not going to overexert myself to try to bend through backwards to jump through the hoops Microsoft wants us to jump through to accomplish the things that I could very easily accomplish for, you know, with open source software. I'll give you a perfect example. This last week, we had a company, they're getting an audit by a third-party accounting firm. The third-party accounting firm wanted access to their QuickBooks box. Their QuickBooks box runs on a standalone Windows 10 machine. That means without terminal services, you can't have multiple RDP sessions in. Oh, by the way, the person sitting in front of the computer gets kicked out when the remote person RDPs in. So this accounting firm is trying to do their auditing, but every time they log in, the person that is working at the facility gets shut down. So the ticket comes in the following, right? It says, hey, I'm getting a black screen and then kicked out to the login prompt every once in a while. I don't know what's happening. From the auditing company, I'm getting tickets saying things like, hey, we can only have one user logged in at the same time. We price it out. It ends up being, I don't know, $2,500. I don't remember what it was. To get everything all set up with terminal services, client looks like as like we have six eyes. Hey, we're already paying this accounting firm tens of thousands of dollars, and you want us to pay thousands of dollars more for a piece of software you can use one time? Get out of here. And it's like, okay, but that's what I don't have any say in that. And so what I found is an effective strategy. My belief system really hasn't changed. I still think people are better served using the open source alternatives, but my strategy has evolved a bit, and I'd like to think it's gotten a little bit more clever. So I will make the open source alternative as easy and greased of a path as humanly possible. All the polish, all the things in the world. My answer to proprietary stuff is largely, yeah, I mean, that's what you're going to get with Microsoft, right? And you watch them follow the... What am I trying to say? You watch them suffer the consequences of their own actions. Best, most recent example I have of that, my son's friend. He wants a gaming machine. He comes over. We build a gaming machine. We get to the operating system portion. He thinks he wants Windows. I said, great, get out your wallet and we'll spend $200 and buy Windows. What do you mean $200? Yeah, that's right. I sold you the parts for X amount of dollars. Now you're going to spend twice that just in the license to be able to get Windows. Turned out Linux was a pretty good solution in his case, right? In that case, when you set it up like that, he was thankful for Linux because that was the thing that he had this pile of hardware, and I asked him, what are you going to do with it? It's all assembled. It functions. It passes all the system tests. Now you need some software to run on it. What do you want to put on it? Well, can I get Windows? Sure. Here it is on Amazon.com or the Microsoft Store. By the way, funny thing. If you buy the digital copy, it costs more money than buying the USB key and having it shipped to you. What's that about? So letting people suffer the consequences of their own actions, I think, can be an effective way to kind of, I don't know, Steve, grease the wheels, I guess?
Yep, I don't disagree.
Overall, I agree with you, though. Like, in the end, it's always a more effective strategy to help people get to where they're going than it is to try to get them to go where you're going. So I get where you're coming from, and in the end, it's just technology, but I do think there is a benefit to leveraging the open source side. So if you can do that, Wayne, I highly suggest you consider it. Hank writes in and says, "Hi, Noah and Steve, thanks for always the interesting cast. I really do enjoy listening to both of you. I wanted to comment on your recent comments of WRT KDE Plasma 6. This release moves Plasma from Qt5 to Qt6. To draw on the well-worn analogy, this is replacing the foundation of your house. Qt is the foundation on which Plasma runs. As such, it's a pretty significant change. I'm sure their focus was on changing all of that API calls to Qt6 rather than any direct additional functionality. The changes were mostly where you can't see them. I expect 6.2 to introduce more changes that are obvious to the user. As far as visioning goes, using 6 makes sense in my opinion because they switched to Qt6. 6X would reflect a feature change and 6XN would reflect bug fixes. The Linux kernel versioning is different. At present, Torvalds changes the major number when he feels like it. There's no inference as to what's going to 5.19 to 6.0. It means more than going 6.0 to 6.1. Best. So, I appreciate the feedback. I didn't hear a question in there, but I think he's spot on.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, semantic versioning is contentious at best. Some people look for meaning in it, and some people can deal with the fact that, you know what, it's just kind of a random number. Honestly, most of the thing until you hit 1.0 is kind of random. 1.0 is usually the it's okay for general consumption. Past that, anything else seems to lack any kind of consensus in all worlds that I have seen.
From the Linux Newswire newsroom, this is the Week in Review with JT.
For the week of March 10th, 2024, here's the Linux and open source news. According to StatCounter, Linux has reached 4% desktop market share. Xorin OS 17.1 has been released with enhanced Windows app support due to including Wine9. Kden Live 2402 has been released. Juno Computers has launched the Neptune 17 V6 Linux laptop with Ubuntu installed with up to 64 gig RAM and an NVIDIA RTX 4090. The GTK team has announced accessibility improvements in GTK 4.14. The LXQT team has stated that they are now 100% ready for Wayland. The Linux 6.4 kernel has been released, and the Linux 6.9 kernel will include an upgrade to the Rust toolchain. In security news, researchers had unearthed Linux malware that they have dubbed Nerbian Rat that has circulated in the wild for at least 2 years before being identified as a credential stealer that's installed by the exploitation of recently patched vulnerabilities. CISA has held an open-source software security summit where software leaders, including industry and federal agencies, have gathered together to announce a plan of action to bolster the security of the open-source ecosystem. And in AI news, Elon Musk has announced that he will be open-sourcing X's Grok AI. And lastly, Opus 1.5 has received a machine learning upgrade. Although Opus has included machine learning and even deep learning before, like with its speech and music detection, this is the first time it has used deep learning techniques to process or generate the signals themselves.
Last week, we gave you a bit of an insight into managing stress and work-life balance. But what happens when you actually dig in to doing the work? How do you become efficient? And how do you wrap a process around getting work done? So, Steve and I thought that would be a great topic tonight for us to discuss. So, Steve, I want to start here. What led you down the path of wanting to get your head wrapped around tasks?
So, sometimes when you're in my line of work, you end up with a client that has a laundry list of activities or questions and not really an end goal in mind. And that makes it a lot more challenging to make sure that you're staying on task, that you're accomplishing everything you need, that you're showing value to the client, because ultimately, you know, they're paying for your time and you want to put your best foot forward. You know, there's a biblical principle that basically says that you should work as if you're working unto God. And so you end up with a situation where you get questions via email, you get questions in phone calls, you've got questions that come up because you've got a statement of work. You've got all these kind of various inputs, and how do you track them all? Like sometimes we usually just reply to the email, but maybe the reply to the email is not tracked well enough. I've absolutely run into this where someone says, hey, you know, we asked you this question, and this is like at the project wrap up, and you say, oh, well, I've responded, and there's like a little bit of a back and forth until you can produce an email. Because maybe the response was forgotten, or maybe they sent a follow-up question and that gets missed or whatever. And so there's, in order to put the best foot forward and make sure that I'm giving them the best service I can, you have to figure out, like, how are you tracking these things? Like so for example, I get a question about AI and it takes me 4 hours out of my 8-hour day to do it. And then I have to report. So it's some random person, like part of the team, but not part of the management structure, that asked me this question. It's legitimate. I go find the answer. And then the management's like, well, why'd you bill me 8 hours when you only have 4 hours of tangible thing that you can show that you did, right? And so while not directly related to time tracking, the thought is, how are you correlating all of this information and collecting it and keeping track of it, keeping it straight in your brain? Like, I normally write stuff down and I have copious amounts of notes, but sometimes even that fails because you end up with so many sticky notes all over the place. It's like, did I answer this one? And, you know, I can't remember what state this was in. And sticky notes don't really allow you to put a ton of comments in them, unlike other tools. So that's really where this, where my journey began.
So it's interesting. Your timing of this is actually really interesting, because I would say for about the better half of a year or two, I've been challenged with this, and I've been trying to work out my own way around this. At AltaSpeed, it's fairly straightforward. We have a ticket system, so if you want help, you fill out a ticket system, and we are wicked fast at getting back to people. And so that's pretty easy. Log into the ticket system, find which ones are assigned to me, do them, document the work in the ticket, problem solved, I'm done. it's a little bit more dicey with some of the other organizations that I work for. So Layton, for example, I help out there with IT part-time, and it's a mess of things. It can be everything from somebody will hand me on a written piece of paper a note to send a text message to send an email. It just all depends. And then I'm on staff part-time at my local church, and in that role we use something called Paycor, where they assign tasks. And so there's a variety of different ways that tasks come to me, and I needed a standardized way to kind of bring about the tasks into a thing that I can prioritize them, divvy up into subtasks, do the work, mark, keep track of what things I've done, what things I haven't, and then, and this is a really important thing, track the time. Because oftentimes it goes something like this. Oh, I'm going to start this install. While that's working, I'm going to run over here and do this. And while that's doing, I'm going to run and pick up that thing. And so if all of these entities, so to speak, are overlapping with each other, how do you know what went to what cookie goes in what cookie jar? It can become kind of a mess. And so there are two tools that I've landed on that have really helped me. The first is Super Productivity. So Super Productivity is a task manager for ADD people. And what I mean by that is all the squirrels that are running around, you can put them into projects. Then you can divvy out those projects into an organized list of tasks, and then you can tell Super Productivity, here is the task I'm currently working on, and it will begin tracking the time for that task. And at the end, it kind of gives you an end-of-day report and says, hey, here's how productive you were, here's what you were able to accomplish, here's the part that is still missing. And if you get off task, or you don't track a task, it will say, hey, you're not tracking your time. Are you working on something? And it'll give you this obnoxious pop-up, and you can say, oh, sorry, I forgot. I got distracted watching cat videos on YouTube. I'll get back to work. And then I pick a task, and then I go back to work on it. Similarly, if you are working on a task and you're just really in the mode, it will tell you, hey, you've gone, you know, an hour or 2 hours, and you haven't had a break. You're more productive if you take a short 10, 15-minute break. Why don't you take a break and work on something else? And the third thing that I find it's really helpful with is controlling context switching. When you have trouble focusing, it can become very tempting to, like, so I'm working on thing A, and then thing A causes me to go reference thing B. But once I open up thing B, I realize there's things C, D, and E that need to be worked on. And so pretty soon, before I know it, I've entirely departed my task A, and I'm working on task F. And it's like, okay, this is not good, right? And so Super Productivity helps in that regard, because as a new task comes in, or as I discover, oh yeah, that's right, I have to, okay, great. Put it in the appropriate project, get to it when I decide I'm going to get to it. And that's been really, really helpful for me. The second tool is a tool called Simple Time Tracker. Now, so far as I know, it's not available on Linux. It's only available on Android. But what I really like about it is it allows you to, it does exactly what what the name describes. It simply tracks time. But it does so in a very elegant and intuitive way. So you create projects, you tap on the project, and it starts tracking time. When you get done, you can export a report. And that's what I'm using to say, oh, I ran to Lowe's to grab parts for this install. And then in between that, I went and started a thing while I was, provisioning a computer. And while I did that, I went and re-kicked the server while I was waiting for, you know, as I'm switching things, I'm just tapping in Simple Time Tracker, and it's keeping track. Spent 15 minutes there, spent an hour there, spent 40 minutes there. And even though I may be all over the place, depending on what part of town I'm in or what I'm working on, it keeps track of all of that. And at the end, I can export a report and then divvy up all the hours and or the billable things to the various people. It works pretty well. I understand that you have started down the route of a Kanban board. For those that aren't initiated, what's a Kanban board?
So I suppose the way I would describe it is it's like using digital post-it notes, except on steroids. So the idea is you have a little card on your web front end, which is where a Kanban board normally runs, and you normally have columns, and the columns have headings such as I'm doing, they're pending, they're done, they're blocked, you know, waiting for such and such a person, something like that. And what you can do with this, for the people that are not familiar, is you can set up tags that have specific colors. And what it's meant to do is to really give you a visual glance as to how you're progressing. So I'm looking at one that I have for a client right now, and I have things on here like documentation and do an architecture review of the client environment and provide architecture diagrams. And I have those flagged with documentation required. And as I do them, you can open them up and you can add descriptions and you can add a checklist and subtasks and all kinds of fun stuff, including if you're working with multiple people, you can assign members or attach people to the same. And have a to really track my thoughts, because part of this is I have to track where the request is coming in from just for my own sanity. So like I get various questions from the client because I'm working with more than one person there, and I have to track, you know, is this a customer question? Was this, did it come in say a Red Hat ticket, or, you know, where did this come from? As opposed to these were the goals that were set out by the project, so that I don't end up losing anything, slipping through the cracks. And it allows me to, it also, honestly, that achiever in me, it's almost like putting a little checkbox. When I see all of the cards starting to stack up in the done column, you know, it gives me the warm and fuzzies. And it also, honestly, it gives a really good representation to the client where I can take a screenshot and be like, look, this is the status that we're at. And they can get at a glance, they can see what I'm doing, what's been done, you know, and it's a really easy thing to share quickly for someone to be able to glance at it and understand what you've prioritized and what is actually being accomplished.
So the kind of the go-to well-known open source Kanban board is Nextcloud Tasks. As you searched for a Kanban board, did you evaluate tasks? And if so, what did you think of it?
I was unable to find the actual Kanban section of it. Like, so I installed Nextcloud Task. I see a bunch of tasks there. I can see you put them, like you can physically put them in done or doing or whatever. But in terms of visual representation, I don't know where it's hiding. Maybe it's end user error, but I was unable to replicate the flow that I was looking for in the Nextcloud Tasks.
So same, I've tried Nextcloud Tasks. I found it, well, let's just put it this way. If you're used to Trello, it isn't going to be a one-for-one comparison. Well, we'll just leave it at that. So as you looked around for open source Kanban boards, what did you eventually land on and what do you like about it?
So I ended up installing this one called WeCan, and I like it quite a bit. I think that it looks really sharp. They've done a really good job with the presentation layer. It's open source, so I'm just self-hosting it. It took me almost no time. I had a little tiny hiccup, which was well documented on their site. Like it generated an error when I created a user. And that was expected because it generates the error if you haven't plugged email into it when you set it up, which I didn't. But as a person that's just like essentially following the WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, and clicking along, everything worked perfectly until I created the user and then I got an error. But as soon as I went to the website, like it's right there, like it's in the FAQ, is like, this is okay. It just means you haven't set up email. So yeah, it's straightforward, easy. Like the on-ramp is easy if you've used anything remotely similar.
So is it web-based? Is it local? How does it work?
Yeah, so most Kanban boards, to be effective, they run in the web browser. So this one is just a gobbledygook of like JavaScript and stuff like that. And yeah, I'm self-hosting it because they have that option. And there's plenty of ways to self-host it between going and getting like a Docker compose file to running it yourself. There's all kinds of ways. So
walk me through this. You have the Kanban board set up. You're given a task list or a statement of work. You're like, hey, this is what I want you to accomplish. Walk me through your process. How does it go from a sticky note that somebody hands Steve or an email or a verbal conversation to, hey, this thing that you've asked for is now complete? And also, I might ask, how do you insert some vision? So let's say you're given a general idea. I say, Steve, you know what I'm looking for? I'm looking for a container system that's going to host my, my widgets, and I'm looking for this on the widget. Well, okay, there's about 99 questions that you would need to answer before you could accurately deliver that, but maybe you're not given that, and so you're kind of left to stumble around in the dark on your own home lab. How do you deal with that, and how does the Kanban board help?
So one of the things that you can do with this, just like a ticketing system, you can create subtasks. So your task might be, you know, super awesome website. But then your subtasks is are things like security, user management, and a good UX with good user widgets, right? And each one of those would be a subtask underneath the make the super awesome website. So all of those start in what I would call the backlog. There's a in the industry, generally speaking, if there's a task you haven't gotten to, it sits in a place called the backlog or the parking lot. And this is where you create all your tasks, even if you haven't done anything with them. And generally the flow is backlog, in progress or doing, pending, which could be like pending review or, you know, some sort of sign off, and then done. And then you might have a blocked column for things that you can't work on. And it's easy to call out if you just basically you make an item and you drag it over into the blocked column. Project managers don't like to see anything in that blocked column. So that gets a lot more attention than just simply sending an email. If there's a visual representation of something that you can't do because you're blocked, that gets people's attention way faster than sending an email. So to answer your question succinctly, there you basically you get an item, you try and figure out how to succinctly write it in just like a couple lines or something like that. You click the little plus, you type out your description, a brief description so that it's easy to read at a glance, and maybe you put some color, kind of color tags to indicate what type of work there is. Once you start working on it, you just drag it into the doing column, and then at this point you start entering notes like, if you're producing documentation, here's the link to the documentation. If there's salient information somewhere else that you can link to, or even posting like code snippets, like did this, got this output sort of thing, that can all go inside one of these little tickets that you can just open up on a click, and you just drag it through the process until it's done.
How about data sharing or export functionality? So you're getting these things done. You talked about doing some screenshots, which I think is probably an effective way to very quickly share that kind of at-a-glance thing. Is there a way to export the data and or make that data shareable and discoverable for the client or the people that you're working with?
You could expose this to the internet, but part of the challenge there is that most clients don't want their task list stuff outside of a network. So they might be okay with me having the Kanban board on my own network, provided that it can't be accessed from the outside, but they're not okay with generally exposing that to the internet because they, you know, there's fears about leaking information or whatever. So the board does have, it is multi-user. It's got a lot of role-based access control. You can do things like set the individual board. That's what it called. So when you start a new project, they call it a board. You can set it to project, to private or public. You know, you can do all those sorts of things. So there's a lot of controls put in place. But generally speaking, this is just something that I do on my own and just kind of provide glimpses into.
So somebody is listening to this right now, and they're saying to themselves, man, you know what? I have wanted to get my head wrapped around task management. I wasn't really aware of the best tools to do it, certainly didn't know about the best open source tools to do it, and I also wish I knew what questions I don't know to ask. So what would you tell that person if they were starting from square one? What do they need to know about effective task management and using tools to get there?
Ultimately, it comes down to figuring out how you work, because a Kanban board is not the best, like it's not going to be for everyone, right? And it's not always the best for every situation. There are 100% legit times where a ticketing system with good subtasks and, you know, interlinking between documents you might have on your network and all that sort of stuff, that might be the better way to go. And for a place like AltaSpeed, I would imagine that is the case. Whereas this is more project-based than long-term. And the idea is you've got a start and an end point. And when you've got that kind of goal, you, like, for example, there's this idea of sprinting where every 2 weeks you roll over your assignment. So you have 2 weeks to get done a list of tasks. And if that they're not done, there's some level of accountability. Kanban boards work really well for that. So ultimately, there's a few things you think about. What is my own personality like? Like, how do I like to interact with this? Do I like check marks? Do I like like Noah likes a timer or requires a timer because of the way that he needs to track his time, all those sorts of things. And then the next question is the tool suitable for what I'm trying to achieve? A Kanban board is not suitable for doing tickets like Noah's talking about, where there's longevity, there is no start and end to it. There is, you know, needs to be back and searchable and kind of a knowledge-based sort of thing. So you really need to evaluate what it is you're trying to accomplish.
The Southern California Linux Expo, it is coming up, and joining me on the program, it is Elon. Welcome in, sir.
Thanks for having me again, Noah. It's always fun to stop by. Looking forward to seeing you in Pasadena.
I can't wait. So I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the things coming up at Scale this year. A number of things have drawn my attention, Elon. The first is Anita Zhang. She works for Meta, so far as I understand it, and is giving a presentation on the Linux user space from Meta's perspective. Now, what's interesting about that, sir, is that you have companies for decades now that have been making money off of Linux and have been using it to bolster their infrastructure. That comes as no surprise to anybody. What is of note and what is of difference is this is somebody focusing and making contributions to the Linux user space. So it's helping the average user. How did this get lined up, and or what do you know about the presentation that Anita is going to offer?
Anita is great. She works at Meta, very heavily working upstream on low level systems stuff, and she's been part of the Scale planning team for a few years now. I think once you get to a certain size organization, if you want to see things happening upstream, you can't. It's hard for you to rely just on the vendors to do it for you. So it looks like my understanding is they use a lot of CentOS, they use a lot of a lot of CentOS, a lot of systemd, a lot of other things, but they can't, their roadmap doesn't always align necessarily with what Red Hat wants to do there. And so, the nice thing about open source, the world of open source, is if you want to see a project move in a particular direction, the best way for you to help push them in that direction is to show up with some PRs and say, look, this is what's important enough for me. I'm willing to not only, I'm willing not only to drop off this idea and run away, but rather to help, be part of the design of this idea, help make contributions to move this forward, because it's important to our business. And so Anita's part of a team there at Meta that does a lot of this work. And it's obviously important for them as they try to scale and stabilize and do other things that they need for their engineering teams and for their customers that access software on top of these platforms. But we all get the benefit of it, and that's the nice thing about this world of open source, is that every company can kind of bring in their expertise, their staff, their resources, and we all benefit from it.
Absolutely. Rocha, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Talk to me about what excites you about his presentation.
So he's, he's very well known as a computer science researcher, but he started the Julia programming language, which is, been around for a little bit of a decade, but I think we're sort of in this world of of newer, more modern programming languages popping up, and it's got some interesting capabilities there. So we're looking to learn from him about why make the language open, why Julia versus all of the other languages that have sort of been popping up on the scene in recent years, and digging in. And so he's an exciting speaker. We also have we have a keynote. One of the keynotes we have this year is Casey Hanmer, who's he's a little bit different than what we do. That we all do as software engineers. He focuses on planning, putting together systems to help do like terraforming of other of other planets, and diving into fuel synthesis and making things cheaper making things cheaper and more less environmentally impacting. He's also was an active participant in the Vesuvius project that Nat Friedman ran recently, where they were using a bunch of ML models to decipher ancient papyrus scrolls from you know, from Greek times. So he's got a lot of interesting stuff, but it's sort of real world engineering, not, you know, not the computer and software engineering that we all do, which is, you know, both are engineering, but it's going to be fun to learn about sort of how these concepts apply how these concepts and how this science applies in the real physical world.
One of the things I've noticed over the past few years is a continuing progression of involving minorities and giving women an opportunity to speak and showcasing some of the excellent work that they're doing, to include Autumn Nash talking about empowering women in data and shaping inclusive AI. Can you talk a little bit about how that effort looks like from behind the scenes? What steps that y'all take at scale to make an opening and inclusive environment for women that are doing some excellent work in the FOSS community?
Yeah, I mean, it's something we've been focused on for a number of years. Early in the years of scale, we had a women in open source track, which was basically, we wanted to bring in, you know, female leaders from all over the world to come talk about what they were doing in open source. That was a way to sort of initially seed the schedule and seed the community. I think it's important that as you're considering whether to speak at a conference or attend a conference, you want to kind of look at the schedule and see people that remind you of yourself, or people that you know that feel like they're the same background, the same, you know, ethnicity, gender, you know, whatever category you identify yourself by. Like, you want to see that people like you are on stage, or that have been on stage, and that, you know, you'd be welcome. In some cases, we've sort of seeded the conversation with, you know, creating specialty tracks for those groups. But over time, what you really want to do is you just want it to be part of the main program. It shouldn't be, we shouldn't have a room that's just for one group of folks. We want to make sure that everybody's well represented. And so we quickly transitioned from that Women in Open Source event to a more broad, inclusivity effort across scale. We do a bunch of work around tracking sort of the submissions that we get versus the submissions that we accept, to make sure that we're being being fair. We look at the submissions that we get, and, you know, to some extent in a blind way, to make sure that we're accepting based on topics, and then come back and look at, you know, who submitted them as well. And again, to make sure that we get diversity across the board. But there's also just a lot of recruiting and outreach that you got to do, and making people feel welcome. And so over time, they'll tell their friends that they were welcome and that they had a great time, and those people come out as well. And, I wish there was some secret sauce. I think it really just comes down to be nice to people and encourage them, you know, and find ways to make sure they have a good time when they're out there. And they'll through word of mouth, they'll bring other friends, and that results in, creating a dynamic that and a schedule where people see themselves and want to be part of it as well.
Absolutely. Well, just being intentional and aware, I think, goes a long way. And as a person who's bringing my family, and all of my kids are into technology, this will be an opportunity for my daughters to get some firsthand experience and some insight into what the industry looks like, and give them some role models to look forward to and say, oh, if she can do that, I could do that.
And yeah, exactly. And I think that's, you know, in a similar vein, that's why we've also had this, Scale the Next Generation, which is our track focused on younger members of our community. They don't like it when I call them kids, but, you know, the youth of our community, to talk about what they're doing. Because if you walk, you walk in and you see, I don't know, you're 10, 11 years old, and you see somebody on stage that's also 10, 11 years old, and they're talking about how they wrote a program in R, or what they're doing with GPUs, or how they're creating YouTube content, or whatever it might be, using open source tech, you're like, wait, they're my age. I can do that too. And you start to give them both, you inspire them to get more active in it as well. But also, you know, this is how many 12-year-olds get a chance, 12, 15, year olds, whatever, high school kids, middle school kids get a chance to be on stage at a major conference, things that they can put on their resume, stuff that, that gives them practice in public speaking as they move on. It encourages them to do more work in this, in these STEM areas. And so we've had folks that come into that track, attend that track, see that their peers are doing amazing work, start doing some of that work themselves. And again, I met them when they're 10, 11, 12 years old, I now run into that KubeCon and they're like staffing booths where they're, you know, where they're the heads of product at like major companies now. We had somebody a couple of years back that, you know, she had started speaking at scale when she was, I think, 10. And by the time she was 18, I'm like watching MSNBC interviews with her, among other things. So, you know, it's just helping, you know, helping kids get a head start in the same way that many of us got a head start by being part of the scale planning when we were, you know, high school, college kids, has been important to us to sort of continue to pass it forward.
Bill Cheswick, he is a security professional. Talk about what's exciting about him coming to scale this year.
In general, you know, I think security has been an increasingly important topic, both in open source and technology as a whole. Like just this week alone, I can't, you know, the number of headlines I've seen about, you know, real various security incidents has been high. So, you know, bringing in his stories from his, you know, his experience of decades of working, you know, in deep security, you know, tech has been, you know, we thought it was a good opportunity as a, you know, to bring that into the conversation at scale. We've had an increasing focus on security overall at the conference over the past couple of years. We had Ava Black a few years back spoke about how about the challenge with supply chain. We've built out a couple security tracks at scale over time that, you know, talk about application security and infrastructure security and the like. And so this is just an opportunity to kind of put that on the main stage again, and remind everybody how important security is to the work we're all doing in the world of open source.
Speaking of various tracks and things that are coming front and center stage, NixOS seems like it's taking the world by storm, and Canonical has a whole bunch of effort that they're pouring into their communities. Can you talk a little bit about NixCon and UbiCon, which are running simultaneous to scale?
Yeah. So one of the things that we've tried to do with scale over the years is to make it, you know, then there's, you know, Linux is in the name of scale, right? That's the L. But we cover so many other topics beyond just Linux, because as we've grown from, you know, the 18-year-old kids that started to the event to much older than that now, I guess I'll say, you know, our interests have broadened, but also, you know, it's not just the kernel anymore. It's not just the operating system. There's all the things that run on it. There's all the things that are around it. So we have a bunch of events that we've started to build at, you know, that we've started to co-locate around scale. And the idea is to broaden the topics that we cover, but also to bring in new communities of people that have not, you know, not been to scale before and sort of cross-pollinate ideas, you know, from them. So we have, you know, for many years, we've run like DevOps days alongside scale. We've run the Kubernetes community comes and runs an event alongside scale because we have the convention center for the week. We might as well make use of all those resources and bring people together. This year, there's a couple new events that are out. You know, NixCon, I was in a conversation with some Nix developers mid last year. And they were talking about how great their European event was. And I was like, well, why haven't you done one in North America yet? And they said, well, we just didn't have a place to do it. So we're like, okay, well, let's do it at scale. So the entire, you know, the Nix development community is coming together and they're really focusing on how to get more new users up to speed with Nix and talk about reproducible builds and immutable builds and sort of immutable systems that is and how the Nix way of working and, you know, how you can get onboarded in that. So we've got some hands-on workshops for that and a lot of trainings. You know, Ubuntu and Canonical are doubling down on sort of rebuilding their local communities. They had a lot of amazing local communities back, you know, over the years, and I think, you know, pandemics and other things have been fun. So they're back in, you know, with a lot of energy to sort of revitalize the California community and get the Ubuntu users from the region together. We also had a great event with around AI. There's a group called the Kwai, Kwai Personal AI is a project, and they've been working on, you know, we've all had this last year of being amazed by what all these AI systems do, whether it's OpenAI or Anthropic or Bard or Gemini or whatever the latest ones are called. And so, but, you know, the common theme with many of them is that that AI is owned by a commercial entity. The data that it creates is owned by a commercial entity. The data it's, you know, the data it's trained on and the models it have are all sort of closed and not available necessarily to us to, you know, to learn how they're used, how they're built to benefit from the data that they're training on, to, you know, have control of how that data gets used. And so the Kwai project has been focusing on how we can make that AI more personal, you know, more personal, more focused sort of in that open source world. And so they put together a group of amazing speakers to talk about what they're doing at Quai. Folks like Doc Serials, who you might remember from, you know, the Linux Journal days, among other things. We've got Bruce Schneier, who's, you know, the name in security, if you want to read about security, security online. John Willis, who's one of the original sort of folks that coined the term DevOps, is talking about, you know, sort of what's involved with running these systems now. So they've got a bunch of powerhouse speakers coming to talk about AI. And so what I love about Scale now is that we're not, you know, we're bringing together all of these different communities and helping them learn from each other, helping them, you know, meet across and learn how they can collaborate on the next big thing. So.
Absolutely. Can you talk a little bit about some of the youth-centered programs? So, for example, Growing Up with Open Source, Nova King, it's an introduction guide to open source presented by a younger person.
Yeah. I mean, this kind of fits back into, I mean, Nova King is, it's funny, they're one of the, you know, one of the folks that I mentioned, you know, started off in our kids track, or youth track, that is, when they were 10, you know, they've been speaking on and off at Scale since they were 12. I think they're in their 20s now, so it's probably like a decade of speaking at Scale. And they got from their career starting as, you know, not through a non-traditional way. Rather than going to university and doing all this other stuff, like they learned hands-on teaching themselves software in the open source world. And so I think that's there's an amazing story to tell there. We've got a bunch of hands-on activities for the younger folks as well. So whether it's soldering and getting hands-on with electronics, or doing some programming challenges, or various other hands-on activities in the youth track, the idea is that it's not just sitting in a room and listening to other kids talk about what they're doing, but rather also getting your hands dirty and doing it yourself. And so that's the most important part, is you get to see people like yourself on stage, people like yourself in the workshops doing it, so that you feel like you can do it too.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things, and we covered this last year, we did kind of an extensive interview. There's a group of school age kids. Their teacher brings them out to walk them through.
Oh yeah, there's lots of schools that we work with that bring out field trips and kind of bring them out to Scale as a whole. But there's a group of teachers that work with their kids to make their Scale presentations part of their educational, academic program at school.
So cool.
And Yolanda Cole is one of them. She's been doing this with us for years. She works with a number of the LAUSD schools. And it's hard when you're a kid. You got school, you got chores, you got what have you. So making this part of the educational programs that you do every day at school means that you can really get the time and energy and bandwidth to focus on it. That whole track's happening again.
There's also some kind of outlying presentations that just caught my attention. I'm looking and I'm thinking, I don't know what that is, but I feel like I have to attend it. Things like Songs to Enjoy While Your Servers Deploy. Man, yeah. I watch a lot of progress bars, Elon. I got to tell you, I am in need of a good playlist and some good music.
So I don't know if you've ever heard Forrest Brazil do like any of his content, or if this is new to you.
New to me.
I met Forrest years ago as like a software, as a software engineer. I mean, he's still a software engineer, but we met in sort of the AWS cloud community. And he was like an expert in all things Lambda and serverless. But I think he sort of connected his brilliance in engineering to his passion as a performer. And he just writes hilarious songs about being a developer, or about working in the cloud. And up until recently, he was at Google, basically helping them create educational content in entertaining ways. He's now sort of on a new adventure that he started, but he's graced us with his presence. He's going to be out at Scale on Friday night with a piano and a microphone and just entertaining us with songs about all the things that we deal with every day as engineers. He's got a great back catalog on YouTube, and I'm told he's going to surprise us with some new stuff as well.
Oh, I can't wait. It's going to be an absolutely fantastic time.
March 14th through the 17th for those that are calendar challenged. And don't forget, if you're listening to this and you want a perk, just use the promo code NOAA for 50% off. We'd love to have you out in Pasadena. Come join us in the wider open source community and make some new friends.
March 14th to 17th, Pasadena Convention Center. I'll be there. Elon will be there. It's going to be a blast and a great time. Elon, I appreciate the time as always. We'll get you back on the program soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, NOAA. Thanks for having us.
The music in our ears means we're out of time. I thank you for joining us. Come say hi at the Southern California Linux Expo. I'll be there. We'll probably grab dinner on Saturday night, so come break bread with us. Keep an eye on the Geek Lab for details there, geeklab.linuxdelta.com. If you want the latest, follow us on Twitter. I'm at Colonel Linux. He's at Linux Evans. The show, at Ask NOAA Show. We're back next Tuesday. AskNOAAShow.com. Have a good week.